Hello and welcome to the April 8th installment of K-Chung Radio's The Talking Show. There are, what, another three more weeks of official lockdown left unless things change?
I think, Nicholas? That's the best guess that Mr. Garcetti has. Although, I'd say, like, last week they stopped even saying that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I lost track. I mean, I think in keeping with the zeitgeist, I have almost entirely lost track of time. So it may be them too. Like maybe they were just like, oh, this isn't even meaningful to us anymore. Like we don't even recognize what it is that's going on here. I have this like fantasy that this will basically be like just a long incoherence. Like it will just lead to a complete senescence in the West. And I'm not very heartened by the fact that they've opened up Wuhan, you know, that that things will return to normal other than the dying part. You know, like I was kind of enjoying the notion that literally time would cease to matter.
Yeah. At one point, I mean, people will crack up.
Yeah, I mean, people will crack up, but I want, like, the people in charge to crack up.
Yeah, but like, do you think the people in charge cracking up means good things for most people or bad things for most people?
Well, I know. I think what it would mean would be that, like they crack up in the same way. Like, they just like, aren't in a hurry. You know, it's like, you hear these, like, tales of what, like, a pre-industrial economy was like. You know, where, like, if it was a lousy day, people just don't work because like, what can you do? You know, like, oh, I can't go out there. It's raining. I'm going to stay in, you know? And like, and that was like understood, you know, like in the community, there wasn't like an expectation that things would be different. And I kind of want it to be like that. Like people are like, oh, well, you know, everyone only does like at most 4 hours of work a day.
Yeah.
I just want it to be easier for doctors and nurses, I guess. That's maybe the I want things as they are for everyone across all fields.
Or there should just be more doctors and nurses, and then things will naturally or inevitably those two words aren't synonymous, get better for them. So if we had a society that incentivized people to become doctors, then perhaps that would that would work out.
I feel like society does incentivize people to become doctors.
Yeah, but I don't think, kind of like how, you know, as our listeners know, I've been reading a book on the Federal Reserve, and a bunch of people go to study economics.
Right.
And the majority of them turn into financiers, which is not the only logical conclusion to studying economics, as you well know, Steve. So I don't think that the kind of doctors perhaps we need are the ones being incentivized, although I don't know too much about it. The popular representation is that doctors like plastic surgeons make the most money. Cosmetic
a specialist.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't seem like we need a lot of cosmetic surgery at the moment, but my understanding of how they're going to, how they're attacking the coronavirus is limited, but I don't think that Liquid Sculpt or whatever those places in Silver Lake are called. I don't think those guys have their doors open. And if they are, God help us all.
So far as my vague understanding of that situation now is that's actually a problem, not so much with how doctors are incentivized per se, but how privatized education works.
Sure.
Such that I'm sure this isn't the case for all doctors, but I think many people decide to be doctors out of some fundamental form of altruism. You know, they think, you know, it would be great to like heal the sick. And then at a certain point, it's made clear to them that like their personal indebtedness is such that they had better find sort of a niche.
Sure.
And at that point, the way that the privatized medical system has incentivized things, they're led to certain other conclusions. But if, for example, like in Cuba, you know, doctors graduate with a duty to serve the public and zero medical debt,
right?
Zero educational debt. Then, you know, eventually you'd get to be a plastic surgeon once you'd sort of like paid the community back for educating you.
Mm-hmm.
But in the short term, you know, you have to go deal with Ebola in the DRC or what have you.
Right.
But, yeah. And speaking of Ebola, Bernie Sanders just dropped out.
That hurt.
Yeah, I know.
That hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, like I can brook a lot of shit news these days, but that was not what I wanted to wake up to.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I have a very mix of emotions about it.
Yeah, I as well. I feel that you know, on the one hand, there's no different bad news in a way. You know, like this merely in some way cements what was already apparent and
yeah,
makes clear the in a way it's a relief, I guess. You know, it made clear to me that I really had no interest in electoral politics. Or that I don't at the moment, you know, at least not in the presidential context. And that there were really more important aspects to, you know, that like it was a area of concern. I was feeling concerned in an area where really there was nothing for me to be concerned about, if that makes sense. Or where my concern could have no outcome. But it still sucked. I still hated hearing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think part of me was holding on to some glimmer of hope that perhaps people would see what's going on in the entire world.
Right.
And think,
right,
well, hey, this guy's been talking about a political program that directly could face this pandemic for his whole life.
Exactly.
Maybe we should. I mean, let's not go out and cough on each other, but let's mail in a ballot and elect his.
Yeah.
Elect his platform. Oh man. Well, maybe we should confront it only as talking, because that's all I'm prepared to do in this venue.
Yeah.
Did you hear the speech he gave to his supporters?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So, I mean, surprisingly, but also not surprisingly, was not easy to access. Which is.
It was on Twitch?
Yeah, and but then, you know, like, you should then be able to go to even foxnews.com and see it, you know. Like, I mean,
right,
major electoral candidate drops out amidst pandemic, like, let's hear what he had to say. But I think, yeah, I found it in some odd venue, and maybe it's everywhere now, but I was looking only like an hour or two after it happened. But you know, like, Trump farts, and that's on every news thing.
Right.
Like,
the mechanisms
in place to put Bernie's little 1.5 minute speech on the internet. Anyhow, I guess they all say this, but he said he was suspending his campaign.
Yeah.
That gives me hope. Maybe it's coming back. Which, you know, he did run 4 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Get a new heart, you know, and reanimate that campaign. So there's that. He also he did his best to endorse Biden. I mean, that's gotta hurt, right?
That's gotta hurt.
But he said, you know, like, congratulations to Vice President. There should be like Vice President Emeritus. He's not the active Vice President, but I guess you never lose the
title. I've always been confused by that, right?
Yeah. So anyhow, he said congratulations to Vice President Biden. Pause.
Yeah.
He's a decent guy. Or I think a decent man. He said man. And I was like, wow, that's...
Oh, wow.
If you're reading through you don't have to read between the lines to see hear what that means. Burn.
Yeah.
Feel the burn, Joe. yeah, I don't
know. Oh, boy. Ay, ay, ay.
But yeah, I mean, it's getting real. I mean, it's... I don't feel like it's hit LA in a hard way, but...
Uh-huh.
You know, we... No people in New York. People are dying. You know,
yeah.
Bernie dropped out. Some of Ella's parents, one of their best friends, died yesterday.
No way. Of coronavirus.
Yeah. So, you know, when the news starts to affect people you know, that's, I guess that's when it feels real, unless you're experiencing yourself.
Yeah, I still have to say that it remains entirely unreal.
Yeah.
In terms of my, you know, I guess I mean I hear maybe like third sort of what am I trying to say? Third tier stories.
Yeah.
Like you saying like, oh, a friend of your partner's parents.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like I'm aware that there are people who are in fact dying. But
it's mostly celebrities, you know, and that's, I never feel that affected by that. I don't wish ill upon anyone, but
their existence was already abstract enough that it didn't feel real in the first place, kind of thing.
Well, and my relationship to their existence endures. Like, I can still listen to Joe Prine's music. I didn't listen to it before he died, but I, you know, like if I wanted to,
you could.
Yeah.
Well, I just found out that Christina, the sort of like no wave disco person, Zay Records, produced by, you know, Kid Creole on the Coconuts and Don Was back in the 80s, I found out that she died of coronavirus.
Jeez.
And you know, that, I mean, I have absolutely no connection to John Prine's oeuvre, but I appreciate that, like, he seemed like a nice guy.
Yeah.
and I'm sure that the work was good. I just have no, I have absolutely zero information or insight into that. However, I was like, oh, like, I only found out about Christina because Shuffle put it on. I was listening to like a playlist of sort of like, you know, left field pop music from the early 80s that I've made,
mm-hmm.
Which I used to help me feel good about things. And then someone told me that she had died. It's just like a crazy coincidence.
Hmm.
So wild. But because, like, of all people, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like the, it's not like something I listen to all the time. You know, like, you could have literally said anyone. So the those two sort of things lined up was just incredible. But
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, no, you hear about these things happening, but it still remains frustratingly abstract, I think, for me.
Yeah.
Or at least or at least it's sort of confusing. I don't know. It doesn't feel like a felt emergency, which I imagine is definitely one of the things that's like stoking conspiracy theories and things like that. Because to most people, I imagine it's not. It's just like nothing much happening.
Right. Yeah, I read what's his name, Jeffrey St. Clair. Do you know that guy?
Who's he?
He's the editor of Counterpunch.
Okay.
He puts out a long list of fragments every Friday called Roaming Charges.
Okay.
And some are very entertaining. Some are usually horrifying. So that's been every Friday has been like a good dose of reality.
Yeah.
And I haven't been looking at social media, so it's somewhat humorous in our household, because then I'll go to Ella and say, look, do you see what they're doing in Nevada? They're painting squares in the right. parking lots. And she's like, yeah, I have Instagram or Facebook or whatever. But anyhow, just like one solid counter punch in the face a week has been enough for me.
Yeah, I do the thing where I scroll the Twitter and metabolize all the horror right there. Several doses a day. I've also been going on these long, like, so like the, but whenever it is that I wake up, and then I go on like a 90-minute bike ride.
Okay.
And then it's usually the middle of, and by the time I've like showered properly and eaten something, then it's like the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah. I've been going for bike rides every morning too.
Hi.
I'm only.
Where do you go?
Well, we live like,
and I'm only asking so that Los Angeles residents can avoid those areas in the morning,
right.
So that you and they may remain appropriately distanced.
Yeah.
But just to say.
Someday you'll come over.
right. Yeah.
But for our listeners and for Steve, who hasn't been here, we live, just north of the 210, like just a few blocks north of the 210 in Pasadena. So it's relatively flat there, but then it gets hilly as you go towards Altadena. And so there's there's all these different bike routes and whatnot, but I mostly wake up kind of angry. So I just
like just angry because yet again you have like crawled towards consciousness. Is that the is that the nub of the rage?
Yeah, kind of like the point in Groundhog Day where he's angry that the same day keeps going on over and over again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He embraces it for a minute there. Maybe I do have moments where I embrace it, but the last few 4 or 5 days have been woke up. It continues, and they don't have a plan. And they're not going to help anyone out, and people are just going to get poorer, and what the fuck. So then I get on the bike and head straight uphill until I can't breathe anymore, basically. And I make it about 2.5 miles uphill, which is terribly far, but I guess like at like a what I call a sprint and an incline, that's pretty good.
Do you track these things? Do you have like an app that you use or similar?
No.
Contrivance?
No. What would be like a good healthy bike ride in terms of distance?
Well, it depends on what you're doing.
Right. I mean, like no one rides a bike. I don't think any intelligent person rides the bike the way I've been biking, but what does like a normal cyclist do? Because they seem like they go for quite a ways, say 10 miles or something.
Well, right? I don't know. Well, for two reasons.
kilometers.
One, I do it all in another set of units. So I went for like 40 kilometers today, which is long for me, but not long in the scope of things.
Okay.
But during that ride, there was not a lot of hills.
So that's 24 miles. Okay.
And I've looked at, for example, friend of the show, Aaron Flint Jameson's bike rides. And they are all like maybe like 11 miles.
Okay.
But with maybe like 2,000 feet of elevation total.
Okay, so that's significant. That's like doing stairs and whatnot.
Yeah, so he's, and I'm sure it's not, well, maybe it is, but from the looks of the routes, it's not all, you know, one hill, right? But that's like the accumulated climb over the course of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sort of total amount of elevation that he'll do. So that's significant, you know. And there's a lot of gorges and cliffs and stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
That have roads going up and down them. Like I tried something ambitious and actually like just flamed out. I had to get Meredith to come and pick me up.
Oh wow. That's cool.
Yeah, I was just like, "Oh my god, no." Like I did one of these climbs and then sort of stalled halfway up, you know, on a plateau, and checked ahead and saw that there would be like some more climbs and was just like, oh, hell no. Hell, can't do, can barely walk, time, you know? So it's like, there's things like that where like, you know, I'm not there yet, but like you know, I have goals. Like I want to, be able to do around 100 kilometers a day.
Mm-hmm.
And right now I kind of do like 100 kilometers a week.
Okay.
Between like maybe three rides. So they're all like around 30K, you know, 20 to 40K is how long I would go out for. And that's usually like, you know, a bit over an hour of actual total riding time, between an hour and a half. Unless I get lost or something, you know. But
that does happen on a bicycle.
Yeah, I mean, but like it's a force multiplier. So it's one of the things that's great about it is like you know that like unless you did something gnarly on your way out, like usually what happens is you go a direction and you sort of reach a point and you're like, oh, this is gnarly. Like the road just turns into like all gravel and it's like on a 45 degree slant.
Right.
You know, relative to the road surface. I'm just going to get out of here, and it narrows and there's like extremely fast traffic and you're like, I'm just going to get out of here.
Right. And there are men with shotguns around.
Yeah. I'm just going to go back the way I came to where this was more reasonable and try something else, you know, cause generally you move from reasonable to unreasonable. So you just have to extract yourself.
Right.
Whereas like, as opposed to getting like stuck on the other side of a gorge, you know, like where you went down like an extremely fast, steep hill and then climb up the other side of that hill, basically, and then die up there and realize that if you wanted to get back, you would have to, I guess it's the only case where you couldn't, you'd have to do the climb that just killed you, just on the other side of the mirror, so to speak. But I mean, in general, you know, you can just get out of there. And the cost to you in energy is low. But yeah, no, I do a lot of exploring in South Austin now. I don't go to the bike park anymore. I don't try and seek other cyclists out or go places where people are likely to congregate. So I don't know, but I apparently everyone's supposed to wear masks now. And that's the thing where like, I feel like that would really suck, physically.
Yeah, I've been wearing a breathing mask. It's not fun, and then it fogs up my
glasses.
When you cycle. Yeah, but
yeah,
and perhaps is one of the other than not being in cycling shape, maybe one of the reasons I've been going for on average 5 mile bike rides, which is like not a lot.
No, but at the same time, like very well, like it makes it harder to breathe. Yes.
Yeah, and it fogs up the glasses. Like I said,
what kind of mask are you wearing now?
A cloth one. Ella sewed me a hand one, which I feel reluctant to wear during exercise because I'll sweat it up.
Yeah, it'll be gross.
Yeah, and it's black on the outside but pink on fabric on the inside, which is adorable. But the pink will get really nasty.
Yeah.
So that one's just for weekends and you know, dinner parties. Oh yeah, here's a question, Steve. How have you been dressing?
Yeah. I've been following that advice where you put in a little effort to it.
I should do that. I really should.
I guess it's also an index of how little effort went in the first place. maybe at like, cause I'm maybe operating at around 70%. Obviously for cycling, I like now that I'm like more committed to it as a hobby, you do actually, it is actually much to your benefit to wear all the stuff.
Okay.
So I wear the spandex diaper and I put on all the goofy stuff, have the special shoes, you know, the whole thing. So for cycling, I dress up and then I have my shower, and then it's gotten quite humid in Austin right now. So I feel like I'm wearing, you know, sort of like, what I would say are dressier shorts, and a t-shirt. And if it cools off a little bit, I put on like a shirt, you know, like a white Oxford or something like that. Yeah. But then I rarely wear shoes.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where it's at. Like I'll wear the Crocs if I have to go out across the lawn. But otherwise I might as well just sort of like walk around in my feet.
Yeah.
How are you doing? What are you wearing?
Oh, the first several weeks were just pajamas, just like a pathetic mass of pajamas. And then, I had to let go of those because, you know, like sweatpants should be the one thing that don't make you feel, self-conscious about your body. But Ella has been washing everything on like murderously hot water. Mm. So then they everything kind of shrunk.
Oh, I see.
And I'm definitely not losing weight at the moment.
Really?
Laying around and well, we've been eating a lot. Out of boredom, I suppose. And so then like the sweatpants started to feel too tight, and I thought, well, this just seems unethical.
Oh.
So then I've been wearing like, you know, like athletic wear when I cycle, and then trying to change. I have this pair of Yohji Yamamoto pants from like 2000 spring.
And those must be roomy. Those must be quite roomy.
Yeah. So like they sit like just below the nipples basically. And then still the crotch goes like down to your knees. I kind of look like a turn of the century Irish boxer.
Right.
And those have been great. So like, t-shirt tucked into those, that's been into socks, that's been my style.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Yeah. And that when you're wearing that much fabric in the pant area, like it makes a nice wishing sound.
Yeah.
So I've been like kind of wishing around in those.
Although I'm not really a pajamas guy in the first place, I think since we have to like travel between buildings in our compound here, it makes like sort of like wearing the soft interior clothes less appeal. Like you do have to sort of like do something,
mm-hmm.
you know, as like a token of the fact that you have to like pass outside. So there's that.
Yeah.
I think the thing that as I describe my sort of like, you know, I get going by like sometime in the afternoon in terms of studio or, freelance work. The other thing that happens is that I've started to, we got a hammock and it's been a huge, you know, cause I think in general, well, I had a hammock in grad school that I really enjoyed. But then I haven't had the excuse. And in general, you're not around during good hammock hours. But now that I'm around all afternoon, I take like a half hour to an hour long break and enjoy the hammock. And that's a thing I can do.
That sounds nice.
Read a book. Yeah. Yeah. Do some reading.
I will say it has been a good time to break in the new living situation. I feel like it was a good, like, you know, like all those little things that probably would have taken years to notice. You're like, okay, well, I'm going to work on that when I have some extra time and money.
Yeah. An immersive break in period where as opposed to sort of ambiently pecking away at it, you're like really just getting fully immersed in whatever the issues the house has. What have you discovered?
Oh, well, I guess the big thing is I may give up my studio in Chinatown.
Oh, wow.
Maybe it's just where I am psychically through this whole thing, but it's been nice. I don't know. I just feel like there's a great culling that's going to happen after this for me, whether it's through financial pressure or just through realizing that I don't need it.
Right.
And also, it's just been nice to be around Ella this much. And Chiquita.
Oh.
And we've got a little one-car garage in the back that we don't use that I plan, you know, like when we first moved in, I thought, well, I'll convert that to a studio someday. Right. Well, now why don't I just rent out my space in Chinatown that's way too big for me anyway. And give that to one or two people that need it. And work here and help. Also, it's just an enormous task to keep it up, you know, clean and all that kind of stuff and be more helpful in that respect. Especially when one's ability to earn money seems in question for the coming future.
Yeah.
So why not invest in the things you care about?
So
that's how I've been feeling about it. And so then, you know, fixing up that space is one thing. Also, like, we have a nice little backyard, but it's just like a little patch of grass. You know, like make a table or something, you know, figure out just like
try out a hammock
that, you know, I want a hammock, these kind of things where you're like, I don't know, theoretically people in LA spend time outside, but I haven't set up a situation where it makes sense.
Yeah. I remember when I finished grad school, I kind of had this, and at the time it was less unrealistic maybe, but this sort of like, I had this experience vaguely where, you know, you're in, I guess it was something kind of like the experience of going to like, you know, like the Night Gallery, Francois Gabali type complex where there was like large industrial spaces with inside and outside or 365 Mission or something like that, where you would just spend sort of like an equal amount of time sort of like loafing around outside, but that it would be maybe like your space or your friend's space or like your space one day and your friend's space another day.
Yeah.
And then by the time I sort of reinstalled in LA, all the places that had both inside and outside space, that shit was done.
Yeah.
And it was like inside or like nowhere. So I don't know. Yeah, it would be nice to have. I've been thinking about how nice it would be to have like an outdoor area in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And how it wasn't that rare initially, you know, like also when we were in grad school, you know, it was pretty affordable to get like a bungalow in Highland Park with a yard or something.
Yeah. Cause I remember like, I was new to LA when we were at CalArts. But you know, every once in a while, a group of us would go down to LA and see like one of the people who'd been here before school or who had a friend or whatever, or were just like, natively rich, like that Nordic guy, I forget his name. And then you were, it, but even the people that didn't have a ton of money, they all lived in like really kind of what I would now consider very posh places in Echo Park or something.
Yeah.
Which at the time it was like, yeah, oh, it's $1,000 a month. And it sounded astronomical to me, but knowing how the market works in LA now, you're like, whoa, that's a deal. Hang on to that one.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
But anyway, I hope one day to live in, well, maybe, you know, possibly the implosion of Airbnb.
Oh, those guys. Yeah, I'm sure they'll totally implode. That's not bad.
Will return some sanity to the rental market. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the great calling, I think that...
yeah, no one's Airbnb-ing at the moment, I bet.
Yeah, no. And people who have... who are property rich but rent poor right now...
Yeah.
Are probably wishing that they had regular tenants now.
Maybe those people aren't paying either, right?
Well, but I mean, at the same time, at least you have like some hope.
Yeah, I'm in that conversation with my landlords in Chinatown at the moment.
Yeah, what are they saying?
They're very reasonable, kind people. So I wrote them an email expressing the financial hardships of myself and the various subletters.
Yeah.
And their immediate response was, you know, stay safe. Don't worry about it. We'll talk about it later. Like, we need to talk amongst ourselves as to, like, what would be a reasonable plan for how to deal with that. But please don't worry about it. Also, like, to add insult to injury, the lease I have on the building was supposed to go up April 1st.
Oh, no.
And I was just, well, there's, Garcetti actually mandated that no rent can go up. So I didn't put it this way, but I was asked if that could be reconsidered. And they had no problem with that, you know. But then, as far as I know, the mandate by Garcetti is that if you cannot make rent, you have to notify your landlord by the 8th. So today or yesterday or tomorrow or whatever. And that rent becomes debt, which isn't actually a solution. But
that doesn't help you at all, really.
No, it's like, well, do you think that we're going to emerge from this economy like a flower blossoming after the winter?
Yeah, you're going to get that job that pays you double. So
yeah,
you'll be able
everyone
to
makes
pay
double
rent
after the pandemic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. Like, I couldn't make rent last month, but I can definitely make double this month.
You know, this reminds me of the, there was a leaked memo today from the... British Conservative Party.
Oh, gosh.
And they had initially, you know, Boris Johnson is now in hospital.
Right.
And with a bad case of coronavirus, apparently. But it had been floated that, like, the initial policy of Boris Johnson's government was that people in the UK were going to develop herd immunity. So they were basically just going to sit back and let it happen. And they announced that this would probably kill about 250,000 people. And that's just it. That was the government plan. They were just like, we're just going to let this one go and you will all lose someone you care about. It'll be tough. Too bad.
That was the herd immunization thing.
Exactly.
I've heard
yeah.
so many and, mixed accounts of whether or not that was really the strategy or not. But you're saying that something
well,
was
it
leaked
was,
and that that it.
It was the announced strategy. They gave a press conference.
Yeah, but then
to that effect.
But then there were articles and then, from The Guardian reinterpreting that press conference, saying that people misinterpreted it. I don't know if you saw that stuff, but
no.
Okay. Anyhow.
But then at the same time they were like they told in that press conference they did say how many people would die.
Yeah.
And then they came back with a subsequent press conference saying like they had seen some new modeling and decided that that was a bad idea.
Right. We've decided to put Cambridge Analytica in charge of the entire response to COVID-19. Here's to it. Have fun, guys.
But then what was leaked today was an internal party memo that was shocked at how negatively received just telling people that like a large number of you will die. Thank you. Was. And it's kind of amazing that they were shocked by this. You know, like it's one thing to say that like, oh, you know, telling people the truth hurts or whatever. But it's another thing to say that like announcing that your policy is like you will all die.
Right.
Was unpopular. And that no one could have predicted that or something, you know, like we're going to go out there and say something unpopular and it's going to be unpopular. Yeah. But someone's got to tell them, you know, that's one thing. But to say that you're surprised at how unpopular it was and that you were going to try another policy now that you've realized that it's unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
And that I find that to be the part that's so amazing is that like you didn't know it would be unpopular.
Yeah. Have you seen I think it's a Swedish parody of the art world called The Square?
Oh, no, I haven't. I was told that it was a lot like our friend Rasmus.
You know, like I came out when I was a master's of fine art student at the University of Irvine, California. Sorry, University of California at Irvine. University of Irvine at California. And everyone wanted to go see it. And I feel like I can't really engage with the spectacle when it's popular. Like, you know, I'll watch The Sopranos 10 years later or something. So I couldn't do it. I couldn't see it then.
When are you planning on watching Cats?
Later, when everyone stops blathering on about it.
Okay.
But so I watched it the other night, and it's amazing. It's a great movie.
Oh, cool.
It's a great movie. And there's a parody of how marketing works in museums that's the most accurate portrayal I've ever seen. So if you haven't seen it, I guess we can't really talk about it. But
well, and what's amazing is that there won't be any museums left.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it? I mean, it's not shocking, but a little surprising to me and horribly sad at how stupidly fragile this capitalist economy is.
Yeah.
You're like, so in the grand scheme of the history of humans converting nature into workable goods or whatever, usable goods, this thing stops for a month and half of the things go away. You're just like, what? Like, is there really no, it can't stop for a month?
Well, I mean, it does indicate how the priorities were aligned.
Well,
you know,
of course,
like it was this assumption that everything would continue to work at like that one thing built on another thing would continue indefinitely, and that things like fundamental needs could be met by a market that had decided to function that way in this hyper optimized rare bubble, and that any disruption to that anywhere along the line, like even consider like the economic damage done by things like Icelandic volcanoes, you know, like is the kind of thing that caused major scarcities. Another weird example is like a medical isotope, like a research nuclear reactor in Canada shut down 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget why. I feel like it might have been shut down for stupid reasons, like an austerity situation with the Canadian government. But it turns out that like that is literally where all of the world's medical isotopes were produced.
Wonderful.
So like, or like a significant chunk, and there had been no, you know, and at the same time, no one produces their own, you know, like there's no other sources for, you know, like everyone was just counting on this system where so everyone else's medical, nuclear medicine system was counting on Canada just continuing doing the same thing. Which then when an austerity government in Canada is like, aren't we paying too much for this research reactor considering, you know, what do we get out of it? You know, and whatever, they make their own bonehead assumption about that. And then literally like everyone in Europe has to worry about how they'll, you know, do radiation therapy for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden. So it's like, you know, a situation where no appraisal of what people's basic needs are has been met. Like it's sort of I would argue like a trait of economism in general, right? Because it's like, social reproduction is not even figured into sort of like classic Marxist analysis of these things, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, where do you get the people from? How does sex happen? where do you get a population? You know, these things are important. You know, like workers exist. Okay. Well, how? You know, where from? So I don't know. Yeah.
I think we maybe talked about this last time, but there was a funny thing going around I saw recently that, you know, a lot of people have been calling their friends lately. Mm.
That's true.
And which is good. I encourage it. And now
stay in touch.
Yeah, when you're done being in touch with your friend, you can no longer say, "I have somewhere to go." So now the most popular sign off is, "I'm done talking."
I heard one. Someone has found a graceful exit.
Yeah. Oh, what is it? Let's just use that as a.
I've got to make food.
Okay, so this is the talking show. I'm done talking. And Steve,
I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep going until Nicholas gets a second wind, and then I'll pass off to him. No, I'm done talking too. Good night, everyone.
Good night.